This is the KOTO Community Radio News for Friday, April 16th. I'm Julia Caulfield. In today's headlines, Colorado moves COVID regulation to county oversight. Johnson & Johnson side effect explained. Capital Conversation talks healthcare and the budget and a mountain weather forecast. Public health regulations related to the coronavirus pandemic have officially shifted from the state to the local level. On Thursday, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment released the COVID Dial 3.0, which in essence does away with the dial on the state level, shifting what were requirements to recommendations. The shift to eliminate the dial has been in the works for several weeks, and earlier this month, San Miguel County Public Health extended its public health order through the end of April. That means residents, visitors, and businesses in San Miguel County must still comply with regulations outlined in Level Blue. That means bars in San Miguel County are allowed to open regardless of whether they serve food or not. Capacity for bars is limited to 25% or 75 people, whichever is fewer, as long as 6 feet distance can be maintained between parties. If the bar is functioning as a restaurant, it may open at 100% capacity, as long as distance can be maintained. Personal gatherings are allowed to occur following Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. That means following the five commitments and maintaining 6 feet distance from those not in your household. Lodging no longer has a household cap per unit. However, it is still capped at 85% occupancy per month. While the state's revised public health order rescinds the dial, it also adds several requirements, one of which states CDPHE must approve all outdoor ticketed seated events that take place in a venue more than 30,000 square feet. CDPHE must also approve indoor events with more than 500 people. The San Miguel County Board of Public Health will meet next Wednesday, April 21st, to further discuss the coronavirus pandemic in the county and establish an approach moving forward. The single-dose Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine has been put on hold in the United States following a number of cases of a rare but severe side effect.
Six women between the ages of 18 and 48, within 2 weeks of getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, developed a very specific type of blood clot in their brain.
That's Dr. Diana Colliker, Director of Emergency and Trauma Services at the Telluride Regional Medical Center and EMS Director, speaking on CODO on Thursday. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Federal Food and Drug Administration recommended the pause based on a hypothesis that the complication is linked to the vaccine.
The reason why the FDA and the CDC had this big reaction to just six people out of almost 7 million having this very rare thing happen to them is that we have also seen this phenomenon happen in Europe associated with the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Colliker notes the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the AstraZeneca vaccine mirror each other in the way they inoculate against the virus. So what exactly is this blood clot side effect?
Okay, so here comes the medical lesson. We have blood that flows to our brain in our arteries that carries oxygenated blood, mainly through our carotid arteries.
Those arteries deliver oxygen to the brain so it can function properly. Humans also have special veins in the brain that drain the blood from the brain and send it back to the rest of the body. Those veins are called cerebral venous sinuses.
And so if you get a blood clot in one of these cerebral venous sinuses, or this the brain vein, it kind of causes a backup and an increase of pressure into the brain tissue, and it can make the brain have a stroke. So it can make it not work. It can make the brain bleed because of that backup of pressure. And it can cause a really, really serious problem.
Kolliker notes this specific type of blood clot is extremely rare. But interestingly, it's shown up in other parts of the pandemic.
What's interesting is COVID infection causes clots to form and actually has caused this type of rare stroke, even in a person locally here that we took care of in Telluride, had this special type of stroke, but related to having a COVID infection.
Now, is it guaranteed that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is causing the rare clot? Dr. Kolliker says no.
A firm causality has not been determined yet. So we don't quite know that if you get this type of vaccine, this is what happens. We don't know that the two are 100% related, but there's enough similarity that we're seeing in our country and around the world that they want to halt using this type of vaccine until we can look into it more.
In addition, she notes these specific clots also need to be treated differently. Kolliker says the clots have also been linked to a low platelet count. Platelets help your blood clot.
Usually, we treat a blood clot with blood thinners, but if we do that in somebody who has low platelets, it can have really devastating effects.
Kolliker adds the extreme caution allows doctors and medical providers to prepare.
And that's actually why I believe the FDA and the CDC came out with this huge message, was actually to get it to people like me, to doctors and providers, and say, you should be on the lookout for this super rare thing that could happen, and you should not treat it the same way that you normally would because of this association with the low platelets.
For those who received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and are concerned about side effects, Dr. Kolliker says timing is important. All the women who experienced the clot saw it within 2 weeks following the vaccine.
So if you are within 2 weeks of getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and you develop severe headache, visual changes, stroke-like symptoms, a seizure, leg pain, other things that could be related to a blood clot, we would want you to reach out to your provider to be evaluated.
Kolliker says San Miguel County is still prepared to provide the Moderna vaccine to all residents who would like it. To pre-register for the COVID vaccine, go to bit.ly/smcvaccine. Big conversations are moving through the state legislature. This week on Capital Conversation, KOTO's State House reporter Scott Franz shares insight on healthcare and the budget. Hey, Scott, thanks for taking a couple minutes to chat with me today.
Hey, my pleasure, Julia.
So the first thing that I wanted to touch base with you on is this public health insurance option bill that is moving through the legislature again this year. And you recently spoke with Representative Roberts, who's part of the bill, about what that's going to look like. What did you hear from him?
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is that there could be some very significant changes made to this bill in the coming days. To recap, you know, the bill boils down to an ultimatum to the healthcare industry: either lower your prices by 20% over the next 2.5 years, or, you know, the government's going to step in. The real debate right now seems to be centered on whether, you know, this new kind of government-controlled health insurance option would be overseen by a nonprofit, or, you know, the thing they're considering now is to use private insurance companies to be the carrier. You know, this move would be aimed at kind of appeasing some of the healthcare industry, because if you're competing with, you know, a nonprofit, you know, the other negotiations that are still going on, for example, inflation, you know, the cost of healthcare will inevitably increase over the next 2.5 years. How do you factor that into these premium reductions of 20%. You know, my big takeaway is, you know, after talking with Representative Roberts, is that he's still optimistic this is going to pass through this committee after, you know, a 10-hour hearing didn't result in a vote. He's still optimistic, but they're at a place now where, in his words, they're trying to do as much kind of improvement to the bill now before it gets further down the road and might get harder to make tweaks, you know, when more politics get injected in the process.
Speaking of more politics in the process, obviously the legislature is controlled in both the House and the Senate by the Democrats. Does it seem like bill sponsors, do they feel like that's going to be able to get pretty wide support, or is this going to be a narrow margin if it's able to move through?
I think this is going to be a case of a narrow margin. And I say that because, you know, Dylan Roberts was asked the morning after this long 10-hour hearing, you know, he had a virtual town hall with his constituents, and they asked him, you know, do you see any Republican support on this bill? This is something that did have Republican co-sponsors, you know, in previous iterations, just, you know, 2 years ago. I remember Mark Catlin of Montrose being a co-sponsor of the bill to study this so-called public option. But at this point, they're not expecting any Republican support. And of course, as things progress and get closer to passage, you know, that's when the politics heats up. And this is something we've already seen, you know, with tons of TV advertisements on the nightly news stations well before it was even introduced.
Switching gears just a little bit, the budget is a topic of conversation we seem to be touching on quite often here. But the Senate passed the budget, and it's one step closer to getting to Governor Jared Polis's desk. Can you give a brief synopsis again of what are some of the highlights in this budget this year?
Yeah, so I'll start with the biggest takeaway, I think, for folks, and that is, you know, this budget is dramatically different than last year. You know, to go back in time real quick, you know, they were slashing billions of dollars, mostly from education, from, you know, any government program, road work, just everything was gutted because there was so much uncertainty about the pandemic. But fast forward to today, you know, the spending plan that is heading to the governor represents, you know, between $3 to $4 billion more than, you know, what was spent this fiscal year. Now, when you start looking inside the budget, you know, we could spend, you know, more than an hour talking about specific proposals. They don't call this thing the long bill for nothing. But, you know, there's lots of, you know, individual projects. You know, there's funding for additional police body cameras. There's restoring funding for public schools. And in some way, I mean, wherever you live in Colorado, you're going to feel the impacts of this improving financial situation, whether that's, you know, the grant funding for school construction or road work. So you're going to see some impact. And I think the biggest takeaway is, you know, the state's financial picture is very much improved over last year, and, you know, that we're going to start seeing more investments and things. And that also, you know, inevitably means is we're starting to see kind of a return to lawmakers trying to fund projects that they're interested in. That might not necessarily be related to the coronavirus in any way, but, you know, that they even found, for example, you know, $5 million to fund, you know, the Wolf reintroduction effort, and that was a bipartisan vote. I know it wasn't, you know, there was a lot of division, especially between rural and urban, but lawmakers kind of came together from all corners of the state to say, yeah, we, you know, voters approve this, and let's give it the money it needs to happen.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for taking a couple minutes to chat with me today.
Hey, my pleasure, Julia. Thanks.
That was KOTO's Scott Franz reporting from Denver. March was a good month when it came to precipitation in southwest Colorado. That's according to the United States Department of Agriculture Natural Resource Conservation Service. The combined San Miguel, Dolores, Animas, and San Juan basins saw precipitation 97% of average, with precipitation over 100% of average in the upper Rio Grande, Gunnison, and Colorado basins. But if you ask Brian Tamankos, Colorado Snow Survey Supervisor for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, it's not enough to make up for low numbers throughout the winter.
Looking at 1 month's precipitation, especially if it's better than normal, can help out. It helps out the situation. But 1 month out of 12, when you have, you know, the other 11 months below normal, 1 month is not going to get you out of below normal conditions. So while March was helpful in Southwest Colorado, it was not exactly what was needed to get us back to normal.
Currently, the combined San Miguel, Dolores, Animas, and San Juan basins have a snowpack of 83% of normal. And Tamankos notes, it's already starting to go.
Snowpack has started melting out earlier than normal. And there is always the chance that that we could have additional storms and snowpack could continue to build. And we likely will have some storms that will continue to add some snowpack. But at this point, it does seem as though snowpack has likely peaked and probably peaked there at the beginning of April statewide.
Moving that outlook to stream flow, Tamankos says those two will be low.
We're looking at below normal runoff for spring and summer this year across the vast majority of the state. So in terms of water supply outlook, when you throw in what the current status of reservoirs, when you throw on top of that the projected low stream flows that we're currently anticipating, the water supply outlook doesn't look really as good as we would like it to. Even if we were to have near normal precipitation through spring and summer.
That reservoir storage for the region is at 59% of normal. And those low numbers for precipitation and snowpack aren't just a 2021 anomaly.
Not only are we looking at low precipitation and low snowpack, but we're also running on the heels of a dry 2020 and a dry fall or late 2019. And since we're seeing these back-to-back dry summers and the it seems that things have been dry over these last few years, the dry conditions that we're just seeing right now are also being impacted by the previous year's dry conditions.
And that means moving into spring and summer, Coloradans need to prepare for low water.
We should be in understanding that we're not going to have, at least at this point, it doesn't seem like we're going to have near normal water supply, and that we should be in a bit of a conservation mindset, maybe a little bit more than we usually are, and trying to just remember that we're trying to preserve this limited resource that we have. In this year, it doesn't look like we're going to have as much of as we typically have or would like to see.
On April 1st, statewide reservoir storage was at 86% of normal, with the highest storage at 101% in the Yampa White Basin, and the lowest, at that 59%, in the San Miguel, Dolores, Animas, and San Juan combined basin. The combined basin also has the lowest snowpack, with 83% normal. The Arkansas Basin has the highest snowpack, at 110% of normal. By a narrow margin last year, Colorado voters approved the reintroduction of gray wolves to the state. As part of the measure, Colorado Parks and Wildlife must have a plan and paws on the ground by 2023. In the planning process for what that will look like, CPW is hosting an online education session discussing wolf reintroduction efforts. The session will look at wolf management and wolf-prey interactions and feature Diana Boyd, a former Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks official. She will discuss the management of state wolves, and John Horn from Idaho Fish and Game will present on wolf-prey interactions. Participants will also have the opportunity to ask questions during the presentation. The session is the first of three. Future events will focus on reintroduction and conflict management. The first education session will take place on Wednesday, April 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. via Zoom. Registration for the event is required. Sign up is available at cpw.state.co.us. Telluride's airport is getting a bit greener. According to a news release, the Telluride Regional Airport is now the first in Colorado to make sustainable aviation fuel available to customers. The airport is partnering with AvFuel to offer the fuel, which provides a 22 metric ton reduction in carbon emissions over its life cycle. That's equal to the annual carbon sequestration of nearly 29 acres of forest. The fuel is made from renewable waste and residue materials, including used cooking oil. The Telluride Regional Airport has sustainable aviation fuel available to all aircrafts coming through. A struggling budget hotel in Cortez became the latest flashpoint in the Four Corners' housing affordability crisis last month. KSJD's Lucas Brady Woods reports.
By the evening of Saturday, March 6th, a final notice was posted on most of the rooms at the Mesa Verde Inn, a budget hotel on the south side of Cortez. The notice said that residents had to vacate the premises with all of their belongings by noon the next day. Misty Cornett's family was among those packing up their cars in the parking lot the next morning, and Cornett wasn't sure where they were going to live next.
It's horrible. There's no other options.
She said that most house or apartment rentals are too expensive, especially with all of the upfront costs that most landlords require, like a security deposit or multiple months' rent. That's why Cornett's family chose to live at the Mesa Verde Inn in the first place.
It was kind of just a simpler spot because they would let them work kind of for their rent and stuff, so it was kind of easier.
Now she didn't know where they were headed, but she said a homeless shelter was not an option.
That's just not how we are really, so we're just going to do what we need to do and get a house.
30 people, including families, were forced to move out of the Mesa Verde Inn that day. The plan is to close down most of the hotel so that it can be repaired and brought up to code, according to hotel management and Cortez City officials. And residents confirmed they were given 30 days' notice to vacate the premises, but some were just not able to find housing that quickly. The hotel had become a haven for people and families like Misty Cornett's that could not afford to rent an apartment or a house in the usual manner. That's mostly because the hotel allowed for weekly or monthly rentals at low rates with no upfront cost. The Mesa Verde Inn complex is made up of 5 two-story buildings. Residents were evicted from all but one of those buildings. The motel's manager, Glenn McCord, says that he only evicted tenants who had not been paying their rent.
I didn't mind have to go to this point of doing this, but I had no choice because I have too many residents in there that don't want to pay their rent.
He says that if a tenant had a record of regular payment, he was allowing them to stay in the one remaining building. McCord lives in a house attached to the hotel. He's 66 years old and requires supplemental oxygen for COPD. He says that many tenants didn't pay their rent or utility bills, and as a result, he's been stuck with tens of thousands of dollars in bills.
Why should I pay for them to live here when they don't want to pay to live for themselves? I can't do it. I can't afford it.
The property has a bunch of fire and safety code violations, and according to McCord, it's going to take a lot of work to bring the place back up to code. McCord also says he plans to continue running the Mesa Verde Inn once it's ready to be opened back up, but he says he's going to approach new tenants differently.
I'm going to be selective on who I rent to. You don't have a job, you ain't getting a room, and I'm not renting to locals no more.
That means there will be one less option for local residents who are in need of low-priced housing. And options for low-income housing in Cortez and Montezuma County are already almost non-existent. Lori Knudsen is the executive director of the Bridge Shelter in Cortez. The Bridge is mainly a shelter for people who are unhoused, but it also includes a few units of transitional housing that offer support for people transitioning off the streets. It's also the only adult shelter within almost 50 miles.
Okay, and Mesa Verde Inn is a microcosm of housing issues.
She also says that affordable housing inventory is one of the biggest problems in Cortez and Montezuma County.
It's the sheer lack of units that are available at affordable levels.
But there are actually a number of affordable housing developments in the works in the area, according to both Knudsen and city officials. But Knudsen also says these projects won't help people who are impacted right now by housing insecurity.
It's the bloody time it takes to go from planning to getting the funding to getting the building up and getting the piece of paper that says you're ready to occupy. And in the meantime, I don't know what some of the answers are.
She says it usually takes about 2.5 years for an affordable housing facility to go from the planning stage to when it's actually opened to residents. And that's not the only problem. Often there are facility-specific limitations at affordable housing complexes. The Bridge Shelter, for example, does not take in families or people with pets. And to be clear, an emergency shelter like the Bridge is mostly for short-term stays. But there are also various programs and facilities that are meant for long-term low-income housing. And that system gets even more complicated. For example, even if a person is able to qualify for government housing assistance like a housing voucher, sometimes that person still won't qualify for specific facilities. Ruby Izad is one of the residents of the Mesa Verde Inn who gets to stay in the remaining building. She has a lot of experience navigating the low-income housing system and is currently on governmental housing assistance. One major hurdle to subsidized housing that she's encountered is long wait lists.
I have a hard time finding a place to go with my voucher. And that's with a housing voucher. It's almost impossible to find. The low-income housing, there's a list on there that it's just a mile long.
But Izad says the problems that many housing insecure people face are not limited to housing.
It's poverty, period, you know.
By that, she means poverty is created by issues that perpetuate each other in addition to housing. Issues like food access, internet access, or low wages. She also says she thinks some of the residents from the Mesa Verde Inn will likely end up sleeping outside because they just won't be able to find a place to live.
They're so young and they're just, it's just heartbreaking to see that.
Community organizers were able to raise money and find other hotel rooms for the inn's former residents. One of the organizers, Eve Hemingway, said she booked rooms for 19 families that didn't have housing after the inn closed. But the money they raised was only able to cover rooms for 1 week. Now, Hemingway says, at least 11 families are homeless. For KSJD News, I'm Lucas Brady Woods.
The National Weather Service forecast for the Western San Juans calls for a 30% chance of snow showers tonight, with mostly cloudy skies and a low around 15 degrees. Saturday, expect snow showers with some thunder possible and a high near 40. 1 to 3 inches of snow accumulation is possible. Saturday night, there is a 30% chance of snow showers with mostly cloudy skies and a low around 15. Sunday, there is a chance of snow showers, becoming rain showers, becoming snow showers, with partly sunny skies and a high in the mid-40s. Sunday night calls for mostly clear skies with a low around 15 degrees. This has been the news for Friday, April 16th. Thanks for listening. If you have a story idea or a news tip, call the news team at 728-3206.